I'd like to convene the March 24th, 2015 session of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. We are convened. We have a very full agenda this morning. Just so that those of you who may have other business in the building can pace yourselves, we're going to do the work sessions on 2997 and 2998 first. We're then going to go into a public hearing on 3333. There is the possibility that likelihood that we'll be going into a work session quickly on that one. And then we're going to, stay tuned here. Then we're going to do a public hearing on 2598. And after that, if we're through the agenda and we're fortunate, we'll go on to shellfish. Okay, with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bills 2997 and 2998. Mr. Roper, can you tell us very briefly what these bills are about?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We also have Dylan Cruz from Sustainable Northwest.
Yes.
Who is prepared to bring us up to speed. So House Bill 2997 appropriates funds to Business Oregon to provide assistance to businesses engaged in Western Juniper harvesting or manufacturing. And House Bill 998 requires Business Oregon to establish a program to provide economic development assistance in the form of loaner grants to persons engaged in Western Juniper harvesting or manufacturing. It also requires Business Oregon to establish programs for technical assistance and workforce training. It establishes Western Juniper Industry Fund, appropriates funds, and does juniper mapping activities.
Very good. Thank you. And with that, I'd like to ask that Mr. Cruz come forward and please very briefly remind our committee what these bills are about before we work them.
Yes, thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be here.
Hold on just a second. We're going to stand at ease for a second. We need to
stakeholders from the environmental and industry community. Our recommendation is a due pass of this legislation as is.
Thank you very much. Committee members, we have a couple of fairly popular bills here. Before I recognize Representative Krieger, who appears that he's flying in distress this morning. Before I recognize him, are there any questions or comments from the committee?
They tipped it over and I was looking at you.
No. You can't trust him, I swear. Seeing none, hearing none, I am going to recognize Vice Chair Krieger on Senate Bill 2997.
Chairman, I move House Bill 2997. House Bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 2997 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be re-referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there discussion on his motion? Seeing none, hearing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto.
Excused.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Gorsuch.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Aye.
Representative Woodshead.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair McLean.
Aye.
Chair Witts.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes. And the bill will be sent on to Ways and Means. Thank you very much, committee members. I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2998. Again, Mr. Cruz.
Yes, Chair Witt, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide a summary on House Bill 2998. Mr. Roper provided a brief summary of it. I would like to cover basically some amendments associated with this piece of legislation that we have discussed. After debate with stakeholders and then members of the committee and the legislator, our recommendation is a do pass with a dash 3 amendment on this bill. The dash 3 amendment makes 3 changes from the bill as originally written. The first one is to strike provisions that were related to creating a program for the regulation of juniper under the Oregon Department of Agriculture as opposed to the Oregon Department of Forestry. After consultation with the stakeholders and some agencies within the state, it was recommended that we leave the regulation of juniper as is under the guidance of the Department of Forestry and the Forest Practices Act. So it removes those provisions. The second change is essentially some cleanup language from Business Oregon that helps clarify the intent of the bill for implementation. It also allows them to enter into professional service contracts with third parties when they don't have internal staff capacity to do so. The third change is to directly allocate $100,000 for the mapping activities in the bill to the Institute for Natural Resources at Portland State University. Originally, those funds would have ran through Business Oregon. After discussion with their staff, they felt that they did not have the internal expertise to do so and felt that it would be better at the Institute for Natural Resources, who already has extensive expertise with mapping, staff to do so, and has done juniper mapping work already. So as with House Bill 2997, this bill has extensive support from the members of the legislature, bipartisan support from stakeholders. Our recommendation is to pass it with the dash 3 amendments.
Thank you very much. Committee members, an opportunity to discuss either the bill or the dash 3 amendments at this point. I'm not seeing any questions or comments. Mr. Cruz, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you to all for your consideration and for those of us who will help you get through the final leg on Ways and Means. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Chair, would I move to adopt the dash 3 amendments dated, to House Bill 2998 dated 3/18/15.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2998, dated March 18th, 2015. Questions or discussion on his motion? Seeing none, hearing none. Is there any objection to his motion? Seeing none, so ordered. Again, Vice Chair Krieger, please.
Chair, would I move House Bill 2998 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means?
Thank you very much. Representative and Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 2998 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be re-referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion on this motion? Seeing none, hearing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto.
Excused.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Yes.
Representative Gorsuch.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Yes.
Representative Woodson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair McClain.
Aye.
Chair Wood.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes as amended. And the bill passes, as amended, and is sent on to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2998.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I want to talk about the big elephant we have in the room, because we haven't really approached the situation with the takeover of our Eastern Oregon lands by the Western Juniper. We haven't really allocated any money towards that to get it back to where it was in the 1880s or 1900s or whatever. But if we're losing ground of 150,000 acres a year, at $100 an acre, that's $15 million. We need to seriously, if we're going to approach this and come to grips with it, we need to go ahead, allocate money for it, and start a campaign to start taking that back to its original places of where it belongs instead of the way it's spread in Eastern Oregon, because it's had a detrimental effect to the ecosystem in Eastern Oregon.
Thank you very much, Representative Esquivel. I think that's a very important point. And if you would like to gather a delegation to approach Ways and Means, I'd be most supportive of that. Just please make sure that you don't request a quorum.
I would definitely, if we'd like, we don't have a committee bill, I would use a priority bill in order to accommodate that.
Okay, very good. Thank you very, very much. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing, I guess in this instance reopen, on House Bill 3333. And Mr. Roper, can you remind us what this bill is about?
I'll let Mr. Gallagher do
Mr.
that.
Mr. Gallagher.
The second string.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3333, we took testimony on it last week. We're back again reopening the public hearing. And the bill requires that a portion of the surcharge monies from salmon registration plate programs are directed to fund controlled by Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board be used only for projects to protect or restore native salmon habitat or to remove artificial obstructions to native salmon mitigation. And I do believe that Kyle's here.
Very good. Welcome to our committee. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kyle Linares, Chief of Staff for State Representative David Gomberg, House District 10, here today in support of House Bill 3333. As far as we know, there is no opposition to this bill. It's simply a clarification that the proceeds from the sale of salmon license plates are to go to habitat restoration, stream enhancement, culvert removal work. Currently, that money is being used, I believe, to fund an administrative position within OWEB. OWEB, to their credit, agrees that that is not an appropriate use for that money and is planning to amend their budget to change that funding source. But this bill is just intended to codify that change so that in the future, other directors under different leadership will be similarly constrained and will not have that confusion in the future. So as far as I know, industry supports this, consumer groups support this, conservation groups support this, sportsmen's groups support this. I haven't heard of anybody who doesn't support this, so I would urge your passage onto the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And it's my understanding by passing this bill, we would be supporting the original intent for which that money was voted on.
That is correct.
Thank you very much. Yes, Representative
Esposito,
please.
One of those things that the devil made him do it.
Any further questions or comments from the committee? I'm not seeing any. Kyle, great job. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
And I understand Tom Wolf would like to would testify. Is he in the room? There he is. Anyone else at this point wishing to testify on House Bill 3333? Come on forward, please, gentlemen, all three of you. Good morning to each of you.
Morning, Chair Witt, committee members. For the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. Realizing that you have a large group here and many things to talk about, I will hold to my model of the idea that the Gettysburg Address only took 2 minutes, only I will be even shorter. So I've passed out to you the annual report of Trout Unlimited. In it, it shows what many of our members are doing across the state, and it shows many of the projects we're involved in. When revelation about what was being done with the license plate money broke, or as Al Elkins called it, plate gate, happened. Many of our members emailed me, and they were outraged about what was doing, because I would say of the 2,831 members of Trout Unlimited here in Oregon, they spend thousands of hours doing stream restoration across the strait on streams such as the Clackamas, the Sandy, the Kalapulia, the Crooked, the Deschutes, planting things along the banks, putting in rocks and trees and in the stream itself. Many, many hours are spent, and funding like the license plate, the salmon plate, is important to do our work through OWEB. So Trout Unlimited supports this bill. We think it's a great bill, and we urge you to pass it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Yes, Bob Olson with Northwest Steelheaders. Mr. Chairman, committee members, just wanted to reiterate what Tom said, that this is a good bill for habitat and government credibility. It's also a good example of the important role of legislative oversight, because current and former legislators understood the issue when it came forward and put legislation in, and there's been a good response on behalf of the public, and we support that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Witt, committee for the record, Bill Tooting, avid sportsman. I'm glad to see that this bill is before you today. We're finally getting back to the original intent. As far as natural resources here in the Northwest, salmon is one of two of the greatest resources we have. And the money that we've been spending on restoring these runs, just look how long it took to get the U.S. Army Corps to realize that the double-crested cormorant seals and sea lions. Any money that we can direct to the fish habitat restoration will help Oregon and help the whole Northwest. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Committee members, anything for this panel? Not seeing anything? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Last and final call for public testimony on House Bill 3333. Seeing none, hearing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3333, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3333. All right. Committee members, you've heard the summary. You've heard some of the additional testimony. Before I recognize Vice Chair Krieger, is there any discussion? Any questions? All right. With that, Vice Chair Krieger, if you would, please, sir.
Chair, would I move House Bill 3333 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference?
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 3333 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be re-referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, hearing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto.
He is excused.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Yes.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative McEwen?
Aye.
Representative Woodsett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Payne?
Yes.
Chair Witts?
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes, and the bill is sent to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means. I'm going to close the public hearing, the work session on House Bill. First of all, motion passes. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3333. Thank you very much, committee members. Appreciate that. For the members of the public who are here, because we have a lot of folks in on the shellfish bill as well, I'm going to move to that bill next. And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2209. And Mr. Gallagher, are you with us for this bill?
I am with you for this bill.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the House bill would create a task force on shellfish.
Thank you very much. And with that, good morning to each of you. Welcome.
Good morning.
And please, I'm sure Representative McEwen is going to kick this off.
Thank you very much, Chair Witt, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I am Caddy McEwen. I represent House District 9 down on the South Coast. But I'm here today representing a larger group of legislators, primarily coastal legislators. who are very interested in showing support for an iconic and robust industry that we have in Oregon around shellfish production. In July, the Oregon shellfish industry met in Newport to discuss the federal government's National Shellfish Initiative and what that could possibly mean for the state of Oregon. We had a number of legislators at the table, a number of stakeholders, agency folk, and people from the industry to discuss how we can assist them in continuing this robust industry and helping it to grow. The state of Washington had a shellfish initiative successfully moved and have done some things that can assist their industry. California is working on one. The federal government has taken this on as a task and understands that this is a very important industry to all of us. House Bill 2209 is the result of ongoing conversations during the last 6 months between growers, our agencies, researchers, and what the bill does is twofold. It would convene a task force that would officially bring everybody to the table to work on a shellfish initiative for the state of Oregon, and it has some legislative components. During these conversations, we asked our agency people to give us a great deal of information about what we need to assist. And this task force, four components, is to identify the best opportunities to enhance and expand shellfish production in Oregon, to continue research on ocean acidification and its impacts on wild and cultivated shellfish, which is significant. We have begun that process. We need to continue that process. To create a clear roadmap to permitting process for shellfish production, is there more ground that we can utilize? How do we certify that? What is the process? How can we streamline it? And to continue assessment and conservation of wild shellfish stocks and the enhancement of recreational harvests also. The three legislative elements that the bill contains, in addition to the informing the task force, are to bring Oregon statute in line with the federal requirement that all commercial shellfish producers on both public and private land report their production data to the Oregon Department of Ag, and that the Oregon Department of Ag release aggregated data but hold individual records confidential. And this is almost akin to the model that the ranchers in eastern Oregon are using with sage grouse. So they can aggregate the data, but individual data for producers would be held confidential. The second item is a directive and an appropriation for the ODA for a pilot project to increase the frequency of water quality testing. This is really critical. We asked Oregon Department of Ag to give us information on what this appropriation could be. Right now we have a hammer that we're using when we have weather events and estuaries are closed to production. It's a finite amount of time. If we can fine-tune that with a scalpel, we can help our producers get back into production quicker. The third is a directive and an appropriation to Oregon State to continue the ocean acidification research and add to that a molluscan broodstock program. We need to do research at Whiskey Creek Hatchery to find out how ocean acidification is impacting our broodstock production. It is significant, it's important, and it's foundational to the industry that we understand the process of how ocean acidification is impacting that. So a lot of work has gone into the bill to this point. We're very hopeful that we can move this forward. I'm going to turn this over to the people that truly understand it now, who are Margaret Barrett from Pacific Shellfish Growers Association. We have on the docket today Gil Sylvia from the Hatfield Marine Science Center. We have Lauren Henderson from the Oregon Department of Ag and Brett Brownskin from ODF&W. This is a really, truly a fabric of folks that we need to help us understand and move this forward so that we can increase the production for our shellfish growers. So I will turn this over to the certified smart people at this point in time.
Okay, if you'd hold on just for a moment, Representative Senator Whitsitt, I was going to put you on right now on another bill if you need to leave for business, sir. Okay, very good. Folks, if you wouldn't mind standing down for a moment, please. I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2209 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2598. Good morning, Senator Whitsitt.
Good morning, Chair Witt. Thank you for the courtesy.
Absolutely.
For the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsitt, representing Senate District 28, Klamath, Crook, most of Lake Jackson and Deschutes counties. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2598. Many of you know that I'm a retired veterinarian. I practiced my profession in rural Oregon, caring for food animals in the production chain for most of three decades. I specialize in food animal production and food animal management. I have no doubt that House Bill 2598 is well-intentioned. However, my opinion is that this bill is unnecessary, counterproductive to animal health and well-being, as well as being ill-conceived. The prophylactic use of low levels of antibiotics in animal feeds has been used for more than half a century to prevent the onset of disease in food animals raised in confinement. Including antibiotics in animal rations has been and continues to be heavily regulated by federal agencies. That very necessary regulation is applied uniformly across the nation to ensure that the practice is both safe and effective. The unilateral and onerous rules created by this bill will cause great harm to Oregon's food-producing industry while serving absolutely no constructive purpose. Let me give you just one example of the necessity and the efficacy of prophylactic antibiotic use. Pigs are raised in confinement primarily for two reasons. The practice is much more cost-effective, and pigs are very destructive in fields when they're allowed to roam free, much like wild pigs. Gastric ulcers are a very serious infectious and contagious disease of swine housed in confinement areas. The disease is caused by the bacteria Hylobacteria pylorus, the same organism that causes gastric ulcers in people. The organism causes epidemics of terribly painful disease that usually end in ghastly deaths. Stomach ulcers erode through the inner stomach lining, allowing stomach acids to burn the raw and bleeding ulcerous areas. The end result is usually perforation of the stomach wall. Stomach contents then freely flow into the abdominal cavity, resulting in fulminating peritonitis and a slow, lingering, ghastly, painful death. Very similar, Mr. Chair, to being gut shot. The swine disease is almost 100% preventable by including low levels of antibiotics in their feed. Section 6 of this bill actually creates a private cause of action allowing any aggrieved person to bring suit in the Circuit Court of Marion County on behalf of the public interest to enjoin the livestock producer. There is no requirement that the plaintiff show any economic damage. It is my understanding that the bill confers standing to anyone from any animal rights organization on the planet or anyone else to proceed with a lawsuit to put our livestock producers out of business. To add insult to injury, the bill provides for the award of attorney fees and all costs to the prevailing plaintiff. In my opinion, the passage and implementation of this bill would serve to cripple Oregon's food-producing industry while serving no constructive purpose. I urge you not to pass this extremely anti-agricultural measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator. Questions or comments for our colleague?
I'm not seeing any. Senator, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you for the courtesy, Chair.
Well, thank you for your patience. With that, I am going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2598, and I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2209. And Representative McEwen, if your panel would please come forward again. Folks, just so that you know what happened here, we have a number of bills up. We have colleagues from both the House and Senate who want to testify. They have other committee business going on, and we try and make it possible for them to provide their comments and then get back to their other work. So I apologize. Please work with me, and we'll make this whole thing work. Welcome to our committee. Good morning to each of you, and sorry for the interruption.
No worries. Well, thank you very much, Chairman Witt and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak here to you in support of House Bill 2209. My name is Margaret Pilaro Barrett, and I'm the Executive Director of the Pacific Coast Shellfish Growers Association. The organization represents over 120 shellfish farms in Alaska, Washington, Oregon, California, and Hawaii. Our members grow some of the best mussels, clams, oysters, and goey ducks you will find anywhere. Our Oregon members grow oysters in Tillamook, Neetarts,
Yaquana, and Coos Bay for both the domestic and foreign markets. Approximately 90% of the seafood consumed in the U.S. is imported, much from areas with little regard for environmental quality and nowhere near the food safety considerations that we have here in the United States. We also know that shellfish is beneficial not only to marine habitats, providing clean water and habitat for aquatic species, but also for the economies of our coastal communities. Shellfish is a vital to our rural coastal communities as it supports numerous family wage jobs. During our recent economic downturn, the shellfish industry maintained and even grew. There are many are attracted to the industry because of the unique lifestyle associated with shellfish farming, and as we see many third, fourth, and even fifth generation shellfish farmers. I believe Svein Visa Hansen from Pacific Seafood, who is here today, submitted some written testimony that provides more details on the impact of the industry here in Oregon. In 2011, NOAA and the United States Department of Commerce released national aquaculture policies. These documents created a framework to recognize the importance of sustainable domestic aquaculture in contributing to the U.S. seafood supply, in support for coastal coastal communities and important commercial and recreational fisheries, as well as to help restore species and habitat. These policies led to a national shellfish initiative to expand shellfish farming and restoration, also led to consideration for federal permitting process and opportunities to gain efficiencies, and it led to the creation of state shellfish initiatives. To date, Washington, California, Alaska, Maryland, and Rhode Island have either established or are working towards establishing such an initiative. The Washington State Shellfish Initiative was the first and is the most advanced. It has made significant progress, specifically with work towards interagency coordination for permitting, a work of the Blue Ribbon Panel on Ocean Acidification, and the recent dedication of a shellfish restoration shellfish hatchery. Phase two of the Washington Shellfish Initiative will be due out later this spring, with more efforts identified. There is great potential to grow the Oregon shellfish industry. For years now, our members have not been able to meet demand. Given appropriate resources to the Oregon Department of Agriculture, there are areas currently ready to be approved that would increase the availability of shellfish growing areas. There is also great assets in Oregon that serve the shellfish community, not just in Oregon, but among the West Coast and beyond. The Moleskine Broodstock Program at the Hatfield Marine Center and the Whiskey Creek Shellfish Hatchery are leading the nation in knowledge of shellfish genetics and ocean acidification work. As our environment changes, we are becoming more and more dependent on these important resources. Funds identified in House Bill 2209 are vital to continuing the success of these programs. House Bill 2209 gives the state of Oregon with the foundation of creating a shellfish initiative. It would codify the state's interest to enhance and expand cultivated shellfish production, the commitment to conserving wild and restoring wild populations of native shellfish, and the commitment to improving water quality and the health of our marine habitats. House Bill 2209 creates a shellfish task force through legislation, and this is a smart move. None of the other states have done this, creating a task force through legislation. The broad range of participants in the task force reflects the diversity of the interests in shellfish. These individuals will be best poised to set forth priorities, recommendations, and implementation strategies that support shellfish in Oregon. The charge of the task force appropriately balances the need for physical and social science information and focuses on several critical issues that will benefit commercial, recreational, and restoration interests, including water quality monitoring, research, wild shellfish stocks, best management practices, and agency coordination. House Bill 2209 and the creation of an Oregon Shellfish Initiative speaks to the current gaps of information and defines a clear path forward. I respectfully encourage your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning.
So good morning, Chairman Witt, the rest of the members of the committee. My name's Gil Sylvia. I'm the director of the Coastal Oregon Marine Experiment Station. And my co-testifier is sitting in the audience, Dr. Robert Cowan. He's the director of the Hatfield Marine Science Center. And I also want to point out Alan Barton, who helps manage the Whiskey Creek Shellfish Hatchery, who we're working with cooperatively, and he's also in the audience. Bob and I have more than 50, and it was hard to write this, by the way, 50 years of experience in marine research, so I realize how old I'm getting in writing that. And our two research organizations do a considerable amount of work in the area of fisheries and aquaculture, and in particular shellfish aquaculture. As Margaret just pointed out, the shellfish industry is important to Oregon and the West Coast for a variety of reasons. I'll just make one point about one key producer, and again, it's Whiskey Creek Hatchery. So Whiskey Creek Hatchery, which is located in Neatarts Bay, is the largest independent seed producer of oysters on the West Coast, supplying more than 75% of West Coast farmers with their seed. And that's critical, and you'll see why in a minute when I talk about ocean acidification, the problems we faced. The other thing I want to point out is that Oregon State University has been very involved in shellfish research going back 60 years. And during the 70s, we helped develop a variety of hatchery technologies that are being used in hatcheries up and down the West Coast. And today, we're working on a variety of research. I'll mention three, which is developing oyster breeds, which is part of the Molluscan Broodstock Program, improving the safety of oyster products, which we do a lot of work at the Astoria Seafood Lab in Astoria, and then addressing the challenges of ocean acidification, which I'm now going to talk about. So in the midsummer of 2007, the Whiskey Creek Shellfish Hatchery, our hatchery at the Science Center, and other hatcheries on the West Coast began to suffer tremendous mortality of oyster larvae. And the question was why? What was going on? This was called the seed crisis. We began at Oregon State a major research effort to discover why, what was this happening, and it was all kinds of hypotheses, including bacteria and other things that might be happening. And through our research, we discovered there was a strong correlation between upwelling of ocean waters and the mortality rates that were occurring at the hatchery at the same time. We discovered that these upwelled waters that have been occurring over the last decade here have two characteristics. They're low in oxygen, and they're highly acidic and high in carbon dioxide. That is why the shellfish were dying, and their lack of ability to make shells because of the highly acidic condition. We won't get into the details of the carbonate chemistry, but that was the key problem. So with that understanding and putting together a team of scientists, we went and worked with Whiskey Creek as a partner and did three things. We helped monitor the carbonate chemistry and acidity of seawater pumped in the hatchery using various technologies. We determined the link between the carbonate chemistry and oyster spawning and larval performance, and then we developed systems to buffer the water to create optimal conditions for breeding. Those two efforts combined together helped reduce the mortality and morbidity rates of the larvae and shellfish by about 70%. So it was important. It was an important major effort. At the same time, we were working on breeding programs. Now, normally we've been working on breeds to increase value to the industry and the growth rates and survival of oysters. That effort has probably added an additional $2 million per year for the industry in terms of the increased value of shellfish. But we have turned our attentions over the last year or two now to oyster acidification, trying to select breeds and animals that would survive these newly forming ocean conditions with highly acidic water. And that's a critical effort. This problem of ocean acidification is not expected to go away. The upwelling problem we've experienced in the last decade continues to grow. And of course, with the increase of fossil fuels, the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are continuing to grow, and that's affecting ocean acidification globally. We expect this to continue to be a major problem, and it's going to need to continue the ocean monitoring work as well as the breeding program. I want to mention one last thing, which is the Marine Studies Initiative of Oregon State University. The reason I'm mentioning this is a major investment by Oregon State University to advance its marine programs. One example of this will be bringing 500 new students in Newport on the Oregon coast, which is something we've never had before. One of the areas of focus will be aquaculture, and particularly shellfish aquaculture. And I think that effort will align extremely well with the shellfish initiative to mutually support both efforts. So with that, I'd like to conclude my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Committee members, anything for this panel?
Chair Witt, I'll just make one comment to follow your last comment about students. We have found in our work over the last 6 months that we do not have a significant number of scientists that are coming up that understand the shellfish industry, and it's something that as a state it's a problem for us.
Yes.
And we need to start to create that pipeline of students who can go into this industry. So I just wanted to touch on that. So thank you for bringing
it
up.
I suspect this bill
may help us.
May carry some interest.
Thank you.
Mr. Sylvia, can you tell us why the upwelling is so acidic?
We don't know all the dynamics of why over the last 10 to 15 years the upwelling has been more severe. But in general, these are deep ocean waters. So some of these are called ancient. They're more than 50 years old. So we don't know precisely where these deep waters are coming from. But as over time in these deep waters, you don't get mixing with surface waters. And as bacteria works in those deep waters, the amount of carbon dioxide increases and oxygen decreases just through normal biological action. And the acidity of that water begins to increase due to the buildup of carbon dioxide. This is natural. So when those waters approach our shore and then get upwelled, we have upwelling all the time. What we haven't had, at least we don't believe we've had, except for the last 10 to 15 years, are these very deep water and particularly deep high levels of acidity. So we think that's what's going on, but we don't know all the dynamics of why it's been so severe the last 15 years.
Thank you. Representative Woodson.
I was wondering if you're seeing decalcification of other bivalves in addition.
Right. So that's the same. That's right. So our concern with ocean acidification is it would also affect shellfish and production of shells for a variety of organisms. So this, if you read the scientific literature, this is a concern with ocean acidification and to what degree that this will continue to occur with not just large shellfish, but even zooplankton and other kinds of organisms. This is something that we're going to have to conduct research on and monitor. So it's not just the shellfish industry, it's also our commercial fisheries as well.
Additional questions or comments? Are we to assume then that the majority of the problem that we've experienced here with shellfish in Oregon are due to natural causes as opposed to man-made acidification?
So, well, that's a good question. So certainly the upwelling, again, there's a lot of, you imagine among my scientific colleagues, we're having a lot of debates about this. So, for example, some would argue that even the deep upwelling, is that a result of changes, oceanographic changes that may or may not be related to man's impact on the climate? So we've had those debates. We don't know. Okay, we don't know. And they may be completely natural, or there may be possibly effects that we're causing. Certainly, though, the atmospheric component of this, which is expected to grow, is primarily man-made. It's man-made due to the burning of fossil fuels.
If I may add to that also, our colleagues on the East Coast are experiencing a similar phenomenon. It is not due from the upwelling of this older ancient water. They're realizing that it is primarily more of an anthropogenic, probably coming from runoff or other land-based activities. They're seeing acidity in their sediment, and so their mortality isn't necessarily happening at the hatchery level, but more once the critter gets out onto the beaches. And so their bottom line is we need to know much, much more of what this all means and how it all fits together. And yes, animals are maybe having a hard time building their shell in the hatchery, but that means that they're compromising some other element. So they're not building their feeding mechanism by putting their energy into building their shell. And so there are many other implications of what this all means, and some of the decrease that we've been seeing in the natural set of shellfish when they reproduce themselves in the wild, that also may be impacted by the changing in of the waters and the conditions.
Very good. Representative Woodsett.
I was just reading an article recently in the Journal of Geophysics that suggests that tectonically speaking, the mid-ocean ridges are expelling a lot of CO2 in amounts that they can't necessarily measure, as well as the destruction of the methane hydrates that we have off the coast. We're getting releases of CO2 into, especially at depth, into the waters that tend to accelerate acidification. So there are some really interesting new things that they're finding regarding natural causes of it also.
Wow, that's very interesting. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony and your patience with all our questions. I'd like to call up, please, next, Lauren Henderson, Brett Brownscombe, and Joe Rolater.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be brief. My name's Joe Rolater. I live in Walport. I'm here today representing the Port of Alsea and the Alsea Sportsmen's Association. Our port is very small. It has a very small tax base. It has no industry at this time. We're looking for sources of income. We've approached ODFW about allowing us to grow shellfish in our bay, and we've been unequivocally told that it's not a good idea. We really need House Bill 2209 to help us. In the past, our bay produced shellfish. It's a tremendous salmon bay. I kind of hate to tell everybody in the world this, but the Chinook fishing in the Alsea Bay is incredible. It draws people from all over the world, and they ask for services from our port, and we can't provide those services. We need industry. We need help developing our shellfish industry in our bay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning. For the record, Lauren Henderson. I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And I just wanted to start off by saying how much we appreciate as an agency being brought in early into this discussion on the Shellfish Initiative and to talk about our program and the importance that it has to the coast. I was asked to just talk a little bit about our shellfish program. And so I'll do that very briefly because I know you're pushed for time. The first part of our program is the Platte Leasing Management Program that provides leases on state-owned estuary land for the cultivation of oysters, clams, and mussels. Oysters are the predominant use in those leases, and the leases have established boundaries and are leased on a per-acre basis, and there's a fee associated with that. Our staff tells me that we have approximately 3,800 acres of publicly owned land that's leased that does not include any areas that could be private, and there are some private ports have some, and that doesn't include those acres. The second, and the one that the initiative itself spends the most time on, is the food safety portion of the program. That program's primary purpose is to prevent foodborne illness. The program is highly regulated. It's very similar to the dairy program that we have in our agency. It's regulated both at the federal and state level and is audited yearly by the FDA for strict adherence to the National Shellfish Sanitation Program standards. We've adopted those model ordinances and are audited every year to those. And because of that, we have to work very closely with our other natural resource partners and the industry stakeholders to make that program successful. As part of the program, we license and regulate companies that commercially harvest, distribute, and sell shellfish. We sample and monitor for biotoxins and other pathogens in shellfish. We open and close growing areas based on that sampling and the monitoring data. Our goal is to make sure that the shellfish produced in Oregon is safe to eat. Just for a little bit of background, the state has 7 certified growing areas along the coast, and the word certification is important here. As the growing area must be certified by ODA and accepted by FDA in order to be placed into production. That certification means the growing area has been evaluated, monitored, and approved for production. We have licensed approximately 106 harvesters, distributors, growers, and shuckers and packers in Oregon. There were a couple elements of House Bill 2209 that directly affect our program, and they were already mentioned, and I'll just highlight them. The first, and I believe it's in Section 2, was to talk about ODA receiving production data from our producers. That is really important. The statute as it is written has been a little bit unclear on whether that only applies to public land or public and private. And so we have been challenged in the past to get or impose that production data on everyone. The bill makes it very clear that it includes everyone, and that is important because in January of this year, FDA put in place a new rule that says that the state must be able to collect all the production data, and the purpose of that is, I think the thought is, if you don't have a good handle on the production data in your state, how can you possibly run a food safety portion of that? And so that is really the purpose of that. The second element is the creation of a pilot project in Tillamook, and that is important because Tillamook, parts of Tillamook are closed approximately 75 to 100 days out of the year for harvest. That pilot project would, in effect, double the monitoring in that bay. And the whole purpose of that, it would also split it up into another quadrant. The purpose of that is so that we can be more precise in our closures. If we can keep it open and the science tells us we can keep it open and prove to FDA that we have a handle on the science and the data, that's more harvest days for our producers. And so that's really the goal of that pilot project. It will take us a little bit of an effort if this bill passes to put in those monitoring stations. But I think we're pretty excited about the possibilities, at least in that area for that. And with that, I'll stop with that. Brett, go.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lauren. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Brett Brownscombe, interim acting deputy director with Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I wanted to maybe just build on briefly Lauren's testimony. So we have had in Oregon, we've supported commercial shellfish mariculture for decades, and ODFMW is and remains a very willing partner in the conversations about the industry and where we go from here, including the Coastal Caucus efforts and Representative McEwen's efforts. And like Lawrence said, thank you for bringing ODFMW in early. But continued support as a partner in those efforts related to this conversation on House Bill 2209. So as Oregon Department of Agriculture is, as Lauren identified, the lead in administering Oregon's commercial shellfish program. ODFMW's role is primarily advisory, and I'll get into that in a second. But in addition to ODFMW and ODA, other state agencies, including TEQ, DLCD, and DSL, play a role in the siting and permitting of commercial shellfish operations. Federal agencies, primarily NOAA or NMFS, as well as Army Corps of Engineers, also play a role, and so do Oregon's ports, as well as local governments, who are also involved in the siting and permitting process. So ODFMW's role is primarily tied to the provision of scientific information to be considered during the siting and permitting process, and that information generally relates to considerations tied to estuary habitats, as well as other information related to the science and management of fish and wildlife. ODFMW also plays a role in the recreational realm. This is given that there is an intersection between the uses of estuaries for recreational public shellfish gathering, as well as tribal shellfish harvesting, plus other uses of estuaries related to species such as salmon. And the intersection of those uses and the uses of estuaries for commercial shellfish operations is something that is important to coordinate in order to avoid or minimize any potential conflicts between various users. So to sum,
The what we're talking about, I think some of the broad context here is Oregon's estuaries are key in providing the foundation for many of the activities at the heart of Oregon's coastal economy, coastal communities and lifestyle, as well as environment. The estuaries are, as well as their wild stocks, as well as cultured crops of shellfish, are all facing new challenges. And some of that was alluded to earlier, including space allocation, changes in water chemistry. That was the ocean acidification example raised earlier, and other complex problems that require increased scientific understanding, increased creative thinking and coordination and collaborative problem solving. So that's part of the larger context of the bill and part of what the task force can really, in our minds, help to address. The funding associated with the bill, there are some concerns about potential impacts of on areas of general fund investment identified in the governor's recommended budget tied to other areas of fish and wildlife management. The department is neutral on the bill, but that said, House Bill 2209 and the proposed task force can really help define and clarify the policy for the state of Oregon regarding shellfish mariculture, and as the bill sets forth, doing so in a manner that's consistent with the conservation and restoration of wild shellfish stocks, as well as the improvement of water quality and ecological habitat in our estuaries, as well as the rivers feeding them and associated marine environments. So with that, we look forward to continued engagement as a partner on this effort with Representative McEwen, the Coastal Caucus, and the legislature as a whole. And thank you for the opportunity to provide some information today.
Thank you very much, each of you. Anything for this panel? I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to comment this morning on House Bill 2209? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2209. And Representative McEwen, thank you so much for bringing that bill forward. This is so important.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I appreciate the opportunity.
And I've got 30 seconds to do. Representative Krieger, why don't we do a work session on your bill? I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2051. Mr. Gallagher, can you remind us what this bill is about?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the bill adjusts the penalty for the crime of criminal trespass in the second degree where cases of trespass are related to hunting, angling, trapping, or taking of wildlife, and establishes that criminal trespass in the second degree is a Class C misdemeanor if a person has two or more convictions for such an offense. There is a amendment on the bill, the -2 amendment, which adds specific activities that constitute criminal trespass in the second degree if performed while on real property unlawfully. And it expands the penalty for a conviction of criminal trespass in the second degree to include the loss of privilege to apply for a hunting or fishing license for a period of 2 years.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger, is this bill ready to go?
Yes.
And you're in complete agreement with the amendments as they are presented?
They were some of the ones we discussed in here and received information afterwards. I did have them drafted.
All right, very good. Committee members, anything for discussion here at this point before I recognize? Okay, I will recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Chair Witt, I move to adopt the -2 amendments to House dated 3615 into House Bill, what's the number again?
2051. Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 2051. Is there any discussion on that motion? Is there any objection to that motion? Seeing none, hearing none. The amendments are adopted. Vice Chair Krieger again, please.
Chair Witt, I move House Bill 2051 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 2051 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on this motion? Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto.
Excused.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Prevett.
Aye.
Representative Gorsuch.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Aye.
Representative Woodsup.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair McLean.
Aye.
Chair Whips.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority vote, the motion passes. Vice Chair Krieger, would you like to carry this bill to the House floor?
Yep.
Very good. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2051. Thank you, committee members. We squeaked another bill through. I'm going to now open a public hearing on House Bill, reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2598. And committee members, you will remember this is the bill that Senator Whitsitt presented to us here a short while ago. He's not here. Representative Buckley's not in the room, is he? I don't see him. Okay. I'd like to call up, please, Sarah Basler, Julie Hanna, and David Rosenfeld, please. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Rosenfeld. I'm Osperger's executive director. Osperger's a consumer group. Thank you for considering this issue today. Osperger supports House Bill 2598. And you've received an awful lot of written testimony from folks in the medical community. And so I'm just going to simply summarize the premise of the bill, focus on a couple of components of the bill, and address some of the work that's happening at the federal level that you're hearing about, and distinguish between the two. And I'll do that as quickly as I can. In my work, I have rarely seen an issue where the medical establishment, both the authorities and organizations, have as much unanimity on as this particular issue of antibiotics. The couple of things that we know. One is that medical authorities here and abroad are warning us that we're in jeopardy of losing antibiotics. That would be terrible. Two, we know that the main reason for that is because of overuse of antibiotics on both humans and on animals. We know that to be the case. Won't get into the physiology of it at all. It's in the background materials. Three, we know that 70% of the antibiotics that are sold in the United States are sold for use on farm animals, not humans. We know that to be the case as well. And we also know that a good number of those antibiotics are used on farm animals, not that are sick, but for two other purposes. One is to make them grow bigger, growth promotion is what it's called, and then also for what's called routine disease prevention, essentially just to offset crowded conditions and that kind of thing. And we know that you're not supposed to do that. And we know this just even if you didn't have an agricultural background. We've increasingly over the last decade or so been told as humans that we should be very careful about antibiotics. We should use them only when we're sick or in extreme circumstances like you're going in for surgery or you have cancer treatment. The same applies to animals. The medical establishment is telling us this, that we need to take urgent action to curtail both overuse on humans and on animals. The House Bill 2598 focuses on the latter. And in essence, what it is saying is it prohibits giving antibiotics to animals that are not sick unless there is a very extreme, you know, an emergency situation, essentially to contain an outbreak. And when we say animals are not sick, the technical definition would be to prohibit the non-therapeutic use of antibiotics, which is defined as two things. One, don't give it to them to promote growth. Don't give it to them for routine disease prevention. So that's what that is, both of them. The exception in the bill is to that does allow for some antibiotic use preventatively is to contain an outbreak. And you see that in the bill itself. And the purpose there is to provide some discretion and flexibility for farmers and veterinarians to contain outbreaks and that kind of thing. And the language there was vetted nationally by, is lifted literally from federal legislation that's been written by Congress's only microbiologists, vetted pretty widely with the medical community as well. So this is not new language. It's been looked at by an awful lot of folks who have an expertise in this kind of thing. So that's what the bill essentially is. There is a pretty wide flexibility provided for farms in the event of an outbreak. It seemed also fair to, because that, then that does leave the possibility of abuse and a loophole of some sort as a trade-off. We also require in the bill, or we're asking you to require in the bill, a little bit of reporting that the single largest farms, it's about 100 or 110 of them, would have to do an annual report itemizing their antibiotic use, in particular to take a look at how are they defining non-routine disease prevention, so that we can start to get on the same page over time about what is really the right way to do that. That reporting is limited to just a little over 100 farms out of the 30,000 farms that are in Oregon. And then the final thing is that the bill has been deliberately written to try to limit the role of the state. The presumption is that once the law becomes the law, people are going to follow the law, and that we don't need to create any kind of real regulatory apparatus. And so the only role of the state here is simply to receive these annual reports from these 110 farms, and that's really, really, you know, that's the intent. That's the end of it. One other point is that you'll be hearing from some that impending federal action will make this bill moot. It is our opinion that that is not the case. So here's just in short what's happening is the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is expected to finalize voluntary guidance. That's really all it is voluntary guidance, not a really a regulation much of anything, although there is a little bit of there in there, that would ask drug companies that sell drugs for animals to voluntarily not sell those drugs for the purpose of growth promotion. Just growth promotion, not routine disease prevention. And that's what that is. In addition, it does also require that any time that antibiotics are being given to animals, antibiotics that are medically important to humans are being given to animals, that they be done under the oversight and supervision of a licensed veterinarian. And then it also then loosens the definition of what oversight and supervision is. And I'm not actually casting any judgment on whether loosening up that definition is a good idea or not. It's just to say, if you're not familiar with animal husbandry practices, oversight and definition in the animal husbandry world is different than that with which we experience in the human world, where it's very specific. The doctor looks at you and you only says, you go, ah, and all that kind of stuff, and then gives you a prescription. It's a little bit looser because there are just so many more animals. So it's just to provide a little bit of context there. It is very important, in our opinion, that the fact that the FDA is leaving out disease prevention is a big, 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 big mistake. That's been the consensus opinion of most of the groups that have been following this thing nationally. Even the trade group that represents these drug companies have saying that really only 10 to 15% of drugs that are sold for use on animals is used for growth promotion. That we know the rest of it is used for a lot of other things, including disease prevention. That's the first thing. Second thing is the drug companies themselves have made a lot of statements over the last year saying that they don't expect these rules really to impact their sales at all, which is probably why those drug companies have all said that they're going to voluntarily follow that guidance. That makes sense to be the case. And this is not theory. We have Denmark, the Netherlands have experience with this. The last couple of decades, they've been trying mightily to curtail the overuse of antibiotics on this practice. And in the beginning, they began with just honing in on just growth promotion. And what they found was just it didn't make a dent in either antibiotic sales or the actual practices on farms. And it wasn't until they basically said we need to address both things and embedded that into their rules and regulations that they now in the last 5 to 10 years have seen a drop and also a back off on the overuse of antibiotics. So we would recommend let's take a look at what we know. Let's take a look at the experience we have. This would make Oregon on the leading edge of what really should be done and what the medical community is telling us. So we hope you pass it, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Basler. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association to speak in support of House Bill 2598. The Oregon Nurses Association is Oregon's oldest and largest nursing union and professional association, and we represent over 13,000 nurses, registered nurses, nurse practitioners, and nursing students from all across the state. Oregon nurses are the largest segment of Oregon's healthcare workforce, and our members work in pretty much every setting possible, from large hospitals to small local clinics. clinics and everything in between. ONA supports this legislation because we think it will really help prevent the overuse of antibiotics in farm animals. As you've heard, this overuse can result in antibiotic-resistant bacteria passing on to humans, and as the term implies, antibiotic-resistant bacteria are bacteria that are no longer effectively treated with antibiotics. The ONA's position in support of this legislation is in line with action taken by the American Nurses Association back in 2004. The ANA report found that the overuse of antibiotics in agriculture is one cause of this antibiotic resistance, and that antibiotic resistance threatens the ability of nurses to treat patients for bacterial infections successfully. The position that ANA came to was supported by a number of reports, including a federal task force, which found that without action to address the growing problem of antibiotic resistance, drug choices for the treatment of common infections will become increasingly limited and expensive, and in some cases non-existent. And you can imagine the concern that causes for nurses and other health professionals who are treating patients for conditions that require the use of those drugs. In March of 2003, the Institute of Medicine released a report on microbial threats to health, which concluded that addressing antibiotic use in agriculture is key to the solution, and that clearly a decrease in antimicrobial use in human medicine alone will have little effect on the current situation. Substantial efforts must be made to decrease inappropriate overuse in animals and agriculture as well. As nurses, our members know firsthand the value of antibiotics. They've seen antibiotics resolve infections and literally save lives. They understand the dangers of antibiotic resistance and what can happen if these drugs are no longer effective. We see this bill as a really important step towards reducing that overuse and preserving the potency of antibiotics. And for those reasons, we urge your support.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for our panel members? I suspect, having heard your testimony, that there will be folks that follow you that come in and say that, in essence, antibiotics are necessary for the promotion of animal growth, et cetera, et cetera. If, in fact, that is the case, do either of you have any suggestions where we as committee members might be looking to find some middle ground, or is there none?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, there are a lot of ways with which you can go about addressing this problem. There's a lot of ways other countries have gone about addressing this problem. I think we and others are quite flexible on the details. I think the two things that we would be advising you not to be flexible on is what is a no-no, and what would be truly non-therapeutic use that we should say you can't do. And put simply, you would want to include both giving drugs to animals to make them grow bigger, and you would want to address routine disease prevention. The place where you can create some kind of an allowance is, sorry to get, you know, semi-technical, but is non-routine disease prevention, which is just there's an outbreak, where some of the animals on the farm are getting sick and there's a possibility that it's going to start to spread, then you'd want to get some antibiotics into the bodies of some of the animals that aren't sick. But as the bill lays out, you want to be really judicious when you do that. And what the bill does is uses, like I said, language that's been vetted federally, that there's got to be a good example of that. And then when you go down that road, you want to use it on the fewest animals possible for the shortest duration possible. And so that's what we're suggesting. There's probably more than one way to go about getting at that, but that's the principle that's there. And then just one other thing to address, I think this is an important question, is some have expressed to us that what's in there, what I just described, could possibly hamper a farmer or a vet into giving animals, once they go down that road of doing some disease prevention, not giving the antibiotic at the kill level necessary. which could then actually undermine our efforts. And just to be clear, that's not our intent whatsoever. Once you go down the road of giving antibiotics to an animal for whatever reason, you got to do it right in accordance with the label and at a therapeutic dosage. And so we've said to some in some of the backstory conversations that we'd be willing to clarify that just to be clear about it. So anyway, that's I don't know if that helps address the question.
Thank you. And could you tell us where the peer-reviewed literature suggests we are in terms of losing the efficacy of antibiotics? And I know that you suggested that we're on the cusp, but can you be a little more concrete, definitive on that in terms of what the majority of the literature would suggest?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, we are already, there's a set of class of drugs, and I can provide much more detailed follow-up, and in fact I will after this hearing. There's a class of drugs where we're already seeing reduced effectiveness, and in some of the testimony from the physicians, they get into that a little bit. Some of the tetracycline drugs are becoming less effective. Penicillin is becoming less effective. So we're already seeing that, and as a result, moving to other and stronger forms of antibiotics as a result of that. So it's happening already in the practical world. To the extent you get into the post-antibiotic future that the World Health Organization is warning, there was a report that came out about a month and a half ago that said if we don't do anything and we just continue on the course that we're going on, that by 2030 we get into that, we fall off the cliff. Really hope that doesn't happen, and there's good evidence that the world is starting to come together around this, so let's hope we don't get to that. But that's the number that I saw in the best, you know, that came from a pretty credible source. And like I said, I will follow up with citations on all this and get into more detail in a follow-up memo.
Thank you very much. Representative Whitsitt.
I noticed the bill uses the term antibiotics, and I was wondering if you could describe the difference between an antimicrobial and an antibiotic, and if you are suggesting that we not use antimicrobials, of which antibiotics, some classes, cross over.
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, members of the committee, it's a very good question, and we thought a lot about that when we were advising the crafting of the legislation. The choice of the word antibiotic, and in particular medically important antibiotics, was a conscious choice because, as you say, there are a lot of different, there are families of drugs that are all related to each other, and we wanted to be clear that the drug we're talking about is the actual drug that is in question here. And so the antibiotics that we're describing are what are termed as medically important, meaning that they're really critical for humans. And the in the definition that's most important in the bill is the list that the World Health Organization puts together and updates periodically that is basically their list of medically important antibiotics. Now, this is a little confusing because they use the word antimicrobials as well. Oftentimes it's used interchangeably, but the point is that it's the antibiotics, I'll just use that word because that's the one we're trying to use consistently, that the World Health Organization has said this stuff is really important for humans and therefore we have to put extra protections on them in order to address the issue. Does that
Please.
I was wondering if you could tell us how many new classes of antibiotics have been developed in the last 10 years, and if we are not, in fact, developing new classes of antibiotics as we go along to compensate for some of the ones that aren't as efficient or whatever.
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, members of the committee, new classes of antibiotics and, in fact, entirely new technologies, really interesting technologies that mimicked antibiotics are being developed all the time. They are not being developed at the same rate with which we're losing them, and it's not the business model, as it were, of the way that these kinds of drugs are developed is not, it doesn't incentivize them being a priority for development, let's put it that way. And that's one thing that the medical community has, that I've reviewed, and like I said, I will send a follow-up memo that'll just back all this up with citations and whatnot. One thing they're very worried about is that there's a disparity between the rate with which we're losing these drugs and the rate with which they're being developed, which is why, although on the one hand, we need to be pressing forward with more development and lawmakers can address the issue from that end as well, still we're coming back and saying we do need to also just prevent the problem at the source, or at least get at the source, because that's also a great way to just protect the drugs that we have right now.
Thank you very much. With that, appreciate your testimonies. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, call up next, please, Dr. Rich Carnival, Bill Matos, and Chuck Meyer. Gentlemen, welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please decide among yourselves the order of your testimonies.
I've been nominated.
Yeah. All right.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, thank you for taking the time to hear our testimony today. I'm Dr. Chuck Meyer, current president of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, and we welcome the opportunity to testify today on this bill. As medical professionals, veterinarians are also very concerned about antimicrobial resistance and possible threats to human, animal, and environmental health. But as we have reviewed House Bill 2598, we find that the legislation falls short in three areas. It neglects to take into account the federal law that addresses primary concerns noted in the bill. It groups families of drugs together without providing a necessary context about how those drugs are going to are used and what the implication of their uses might be. It creates a definition of non-therapeutic purpose for use of antimicrobials that includes disease prevention, equating non-therapeutic use with disease prevention is a false premise that is counter to sound veterinary medical practice. It's important for me to address these points one at a time with you to advise you a little bit about the details of them. First, the use of medications and feed has been an effective method to prevent and treat certain disease conditions in groups of livestock, with one end result being better assurance of a healthy and safe food supply. The Food and Drug Administration has oversight over antibiotics that are administered to food animals, and the FDA's Center for Veterinary Medicine does not view the use of medically important antibiotics for growth promotion purposes in animals as judicious. As a result, effective December 2016, federal law will prohibit the use of antimicrobials in medicated feed for food-producing animals for the purpose of growth promotion, feed efficiency, and weight gain. This directly answers concerns in Section 1, lines 21 and 22 of the bill. Another important change when the federal law takes place is that under the FDA's Veterinary Feed Directive, all use of feed and antimicrobial medications will be under the oversight and order of a licensed veterinarian. This is essential, and we support this federal change. Second point, House Bill 2598 categorizes a list of what it refers to as medically important antibiotics. I would like to give you some context on how some of these drugs are used in veterinary medicine and the importance of compliance. The main antibiotics in medicated feeds are penicillin, chlortetracycline, and oxytetracycline. While these drugs were more commonplace in human medicine in the past, their use today has been reduced significantly in favor of new classes of antibiotics. Given this distinction, we don't recognize the direct connection to antimicrobial resistance with these families of drugs that is applied in the legislation. With regard to compliance, in both human and veterinary medicine, it is critically important that the full course of antibiotics be completed. Yet we know that compliance in both healing art professions sometimes falls short. When human patients don't take their full compliance as directed by their doctors, we know that it can create a resistance to that particular drug. The same principles apply in veterinary medicine, and this occurs on a regular basis. Generally speaking, clients in food animal production are in better compliance with adhering to the veterinarian's prescriptive order, in part because they want a better assurance of a healthy and safe food supply. but it's also because they know they can encounter an economic loss if that illness or disease condition in the animal or animal group is not treated appropriately. Third, and of greatest concern to me personally, the legislation states that disease prevention is considered to be a non-therapeutic purpose. We question, does this suggest that veterinarians should not treat food-producing animals for potential diseases? If so, this is wholly incompatible with good veterinary practice management. If veterinarians were to adhere strictly to this guiding principle, animal health would be compromised and antibiotic resistance would be encouraged, something proponents of the bill indicate they want to prevent. Therapeutic use of antibiotics for treatment, control, and prevention of disease in food-producing animals is critical. Under the Veterinary Feed Directive, all use of feed antimicrobial medications will be under the oversight and order of a veterinarian. It is important to understand that food animal medicine is population or herd medicine, and that it is significantly different than human medicine and treatment of individual patients. It is common in production medicine to provide antibiotic treatment of animals when a disease outbreak is expected or in the beginning stages. If disease or disease concerns are circulating within a herd, it is within the veterinarian's professional experience and judgment and purview to issue a prescription. There are greater restrictions on use of food medications in producing animals than in pet medicine. With food production, a veterinarian has no allowance to deviate from what is indicated on the drug's label. That is, labels are very specific in indicating dose, duration, and indicated species, and most importantly, disease condition or agent. Veterinarians have more extensive training than anyone with regard to antibiotic efficiency, resistance, and residues in food production. The number of animals to be treated and the duration of treatment with therapeutic antibiotics should be directed by a trained professional, a licensed veterinarian, and not by a misguided and unnecessary state law. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Chairman Witt, members of the committee, I'm Bill Mattis, and I'm president of the Northwest Chicken Council and the California Poultry Federation. I was also the former national chairman of the National Newspaper Association in California when I was a newspaper man. But I've been doing this work with the poultry industry for 20 plus years, and our industry in the West Coast, particularly in Oregon, Washington, and into California, provides a lot of things you don't see in the rest of the nation. We had the first organic chicken in California. We lobbied against the national associations to get that organic designation. We also have ABF in antibiotic-free chickens, but those antibiotic-free chickens also need antibiotics when they get sick, and then they're moved to another pen where they're not sold as antibiotic-free. So we've done a lot of things in the West because we are in the West, and we do believe that consumers tell us what we need to do, and they're telling us that they want a choice of all different products. And we take our use of antibiotics very seriously. We are eliminating all the use of antibiotics in human production, in human medicine, and it looks like we're about 95% of the way there. We do not use antibiotics for growth promotion any longer. We work very closely with the FDA to develop the guidelines that you heard in previous testimony that actually will be in law later this year. And we think that it should be a national standard. People wanted to take this legislation nationally. That's what we as the poultry industry think should happen, not state by state. Right now, you're consuming in Oregon more than half the chicken from somewhere else, because our family farmers here in Oregon produce about half or so. And so this legislation is only going to affect half or less than the chicken you consume. And you're going to continue to get things from out of state that you cannot regulate. We have veterinarians in all of our companies. As a previous testimony said, we don't have a veterinarian for every chicken because that would be impossible, but we do have veterinarians that oversee every ranch, and they look at what's needed, and we hope that these chickens never get sick so we don't have to use antibiotics. But we do believe it's an animal welfare issue, and we are the only the West Coast chickens grown here are the only ones certified by the American Humane Association. And part of that certification has to do with being able to treat your chickens or your turkeys or ducks, or, and I represent the meat industry, so squab and everything else, being able to treat them if necessary. And we also test the chickens in a random sample before they're taken to market so that there are no antibiotic residues left in these birds. So it's very important that you look at this legislation and oppose it, but if you're interested in it, to urge your congressman to take it nationally and look at some kind of a national issue rather than deal with it state by state. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm pleased to be here and present at this hearing. I am Dr. Richard Carnevale. I'm the Vice President for Regulatory, Scientific, and International Affairs at the Animal Health Institute. AHI represents the manufacturers of medicines for animals, both for companion animals and livestock and poultry. We make the pharmaceuticals and vaccines. I'm in Washington, D.C., so why did I travel all this way through the rain last night to attend this hearing? Because I wanted to convey to you what is happening in Washington with the FDA process. Very, very significant changes, as has already been mentioned before. But I want to also assure you that this process will work and that it will meet the broad objectives of your bill, 2598. FDA, a couple of years ago, actually back in 2010, decided that antibiotics, medically important antibiotics, as they've defined them, seven specific classes that has been mentioned in this room, decided that they should not be used for any production purpose, meaning growth promotion, feed efficiency, increased weight gain, and they proposed to the industry that they should be removed from the labels. At the same time, they suggested that these medically important antibiotics ought to be under the supervision of a veterinarian, as has been said. Now, there's a lot of reasons why these products have been over the counter for a number of years. It goes back way back to 1968, when the U.S. Congress decided that animals were the owner's property and he should be able to get medicines to treat them if he wanted to. Particularly back in those days, we didn't have the communication ability between veterinary producers we have today, cell phones and iPads and things like that. So it was harder to get veterinarians out to farms, and so Congress decided that antibiotics ought to be available to the producer. So there's a reason why this has been. I think today the world has changed, and I think today the right thing to do is to put them under the supervision of a veterinarian. So we fully support that. So back in 2010, when FDA proposed this idea, the industry actually, I've been involved in that Animal Health Institute for 20 years. Prior to that, I was with the FDA and USDA in both the drug review process, managing that process, as well as the Food Safety Inspection Service that does meat and poultry inspection. So I have a lot of history and a lot of experience in this area. They decided at the time that how would they accomplish this, FDA? Should they go through the administrative process, which means they'd have to make a scientific case that there was a safety concern for these products? Very, very long and drawn-out process. They have to present their case. They allow the other companies that are involved to present their case. It can drag on for years and years. They decided it would be better to ask the industry to cooperate with them on this. And at the time, the industry was actually having the same thought. We thought that maybe we ought to move this way. So when they approached us, we said, yes, we will do this. And in 2013, they came out with a document that laid out the specific provisions of this process. And within about 3 months, they got nearly 100% agreement from the industries from the companies in writing that they would comply with what FDA wants to do. So this process is well underway. I take exception to the fact that it has been characterized as voluntary, because initially it was voluntary in the sense that FDA asked the companies to cooperate, but it's not voluntary anymore. The companies have committed in writing, and when they do that to FDA, it's no longer voluntary. Not to mention the fact that once all this takes place, Those labels will be changed forever with no growth promotion indications on them and a veterinary supervision requirement on them as well. That is law then. No one can use those products in any other way than what is on the label. Even the veterinarian has to follow what is on the label. So it's no longer voluntary, and I think that we have to understand that that's kind of been a mischaracterization. This is going to happen. They've set a 3-year time frame. They would like all this to get done at the end of 2016, and we are on track. I have personally led a coalition of my companies as well as the generic manufacturers on this path over the last year, and we have developed an implementation plan of actually how they would do it. They have to go in and meet with the CVM. They have to change their labels. Once those labels are changed, there will be no growth promotion claims on the label. There will be prevention and control indications because FDA considers those therapeutic indications. And so does the American Veterinary Medical Association, I would add. So that there are valid claims, but they will be directed by a veterinarian. So there will not be any, quote, non-therapeutic use. If a veterinarian believes a herd or flock of animals needs to be treated with a drug to prevent that disease, he's going to, in his judgment, make that determination. I would also add that most of the indications on the currently approved products are not for prevention at all. They're for control, which we talked about before. Control means if you have existing disease in a flock or a herd and you go in and try to stem that from getting worse. So most of the indications are control, and those are extremely valid uses. Producers must have, veterinarians must have that ability to control outbreaks of disease. You can't treat the individual. We deal in herd health. So I want to assure you that this is going to work. It will accomplish almost everything that that HB 2598 intends to accomplish. As far as antibiotic usage information, FDA is also pursuing that. Since 2008, they have been collecting sales data from the manufacturing, from the companies. Sales data gives you an indication of how much drug is being used, but it doesn't exactly tell you where it's being used because the companies don't always know. So FDA is working with the USDA to expand a program called NOMS, the National Animal Health Monitoring System, to collect more detailed information on how antibiotics are used in each species on the farm. So I guess I will stop my comments, but there are a number of things said this morning. I would like to just address a couple of those if I can. The problem with antibiotics in human medicine, at least according to the CDC and others, has very little to do with animals. They came out with a report last year and identified 18 pathogens that affect human medicine. Two of those, they related to animals. Those are Salmonella and Campylobacter, which come from the food supply, can come from the food supply, and can cause infections in humans. However, in the whole scheme of things, they do not represent a major antibiotic resistance problem. So the problems in human medicine are mainly due to the use of drugs in human medicine. Should agriculture do their part? Absolutely, and we are. We're moving to restrict the use of these products more so, as I mentioned. But when you get down to it, the antibiotic resistance that comes from animals has generally a minimal effect on human health. I would point to the National Antibiotic Resistance Monitoring System, which FDA and USDA runs, to collect data on resistance in those two pathogens. And 85% of the Salmonella isolates that they find in humans are sensitive to every single antibiotic. I think that's a pretty telling figure that says, yes, there's antibiotic use going into food animals, but if Salmonella comes from food animals, there's still a tremendous number of bacteria that infections that people get that are sensitive to antibiotics. So I think we have to put the thing in perspective. We're fully supportive of what FDA is doing. We would prefer that states not engage in individual bills because we think the national program will work and will be much more effective and much more encompassing on all producers, not just the big ones. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll take any questions.
Thank you very much. Committee members, questions for this panel? Vice Chair Krieger.
Well, I really appreciate your testimony. It's the things we needed to hear, but I do have one question. And about a career change. How do you get the newspapers to chickens?
Well, it was actually, I owned weekly newspapers in the rural areas of California, and my background is a master's in agricultural journalism. Okay. So.
Mm-hmm. I was just curious.
That's what you wrapped them in, Representative, and I intend to show you with a turkey here later on.
25th, supposed to be the date.
Very good. Anything further? Representative Whitsitt.
You know, we heard that about 70% of all antibiotics are sold for animals, and I would just like to say that there are about 495 million people and pets in the United States, and there are 10 billion farm animals, according to the statistics that I have. And so that's a really good reason why 70%, because it's, you know, about 20 times the amount of the people and pet population. So we have billions and billions of livestock, basically, and as compared to people. So.
Can I add to that? Please.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And not only the numbers of animals, but the fact is a lot of the a volume of those antibiotics aren't even used in people. That's an important thing we have to keep in mind. So when you quote 70%, you have to recognize that there's a fairly large portion of that percentage that are not used in human medicine and therefore do not present any risk. So I think that's important, too.
Gentlemen, you undoubtedly heard previous testimony that suggested in the next decade and a half, plus or minus, we could face some potential serious problems in terms of the efficacy of antibiotics. Without necessarily arguing the merits of that point, could you give us a feel for what animal husbandry, raising of poultry, hogs, you name it, what it would look like absent the traditional way that we've raised these animals using antibiotics?
I'll just read briefly. I'm not going to talk to you too technically because I'm not a veterinarian, but in our industry, we do believe we're phasing out of as much many antibiotics as we can that's happening, particularly the ones that use human medicine. I think what you're going to see down the road is you're going to see a little more antibiotic-free chickens, at least on the West Coast. You're going to see that. I would guess within the next couple of years, you'll probably see 60%. But there's always going to be the use of antibiotics if the chickens get sick and then sold. So that's all I can say about that. We've reduced a lot of the antibiotics over the years. And that's because consumers are saying they want chickens with less antibiotics. And so that's what we're working on. But I can't tell you technically what it's going to look like too much in the future, except that we're pretty low on the use of antibiotics now.
Thank you very much. Representative McEwen.
This is such an interesting topic. I'm just fascinated. I know that resistance in humans is a problem for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons is humans tend not to comply with labels. That's and not complete courses of antibiotics. And we have, I think, as a medical community over the years, overprescribed, and we're getting a handle on that. I think our medical community is doing much better. Could you give me a sense of, if you had to compare the human use of antibiotics and noncompliance with a label, compared to veterinary or agricultural use of antibiotics and not sticking to the label, give us a sense of how that would compare.
Compliance in the pet industry is very similar to human noncompliance. We struggle with it significantly. When antibiotics go out of our clinics, we harp strongly that the entire course of antibiotics be taken for the exact concerns that you've raised, mm-hmm. for numerous reasons, some of which I elicited in my little talk. The animal health industry, food animal production, is significantly better in compliance issues. And because of that, we have significantly less resistance development in the food animal industry than we do in the pet animal industry. Okay.
And do you think the work that's being done at the federal level will increase that compliance in the food industry?
Well, I would add that it's always been a requirement for food-producing animal medications that they must follow the label. And that has a lot to do with the residue situation. So because animals given medicines, regardless whether they're antibiotics or other medications, can have residues remaining in the meat and milk supplies. So following the label is critically important for a producer to make sure that labels, that those residues don't occur. So there's always been that much more strict adherence to the actual provisions of the label than there may have been in pet population or in humans because of that food safety component. I think this will only improve things now with a veterinarian in charge. I think some of the uses of these antibiotics will change. No doubt about it, they will change, because I think some veterinarians may have different views about when antibiotics should or should not be used from maybe how they've been traditionally used for many years.
Okay. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much for your testimony. We certainly appreciate it, and thank you for your patience in answering all our questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Folks, from this point forward, we're going to have to limit testimony to 2 minutes each. Is there anyone here from the committee that can you all stay for like 5 extra minutes today so that we can try and get through this list? I appreciate that. Thank you. We're going to have to limit everyone to 2 minutes. Mr. Gallagher is going to be our timekeeper, and when the time's up, your chair falls through the trap door and you're gone. So with that, I'd like to call up next, please, Victoria Taylor, Kendra Kimbrowsker, and Ivan Molesky, please. Good morning to each of you, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Please decide among yourselves the order of your testimonies.
I guess I'm going first.
All right.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to testify on House Bill HB 2598. My name is Kendra Kimbrowskis, and I come from many generations of farmers. I grew up milking cows on a dairy farm, and today, because I'm here today because I raise swine and poultry on 70 acres in Linn County. Antibiotic resistance is a real threat, which is rendering our most medically important antibiotics less effective. Because of this, people throughout the medical community are increasingly judicious when prescribing antibiotics. On my farm, I am also concerned that the antibiotics that I rely on when I have a sick animal are becoming less effective. Just as I only take antibiotics for myself when I absolutely need them, I only use antibiotics on my farm when I have no other choice for a sick animal. But as many farmers I know and myself attempt to be responsible with our antibiotic use, it appalls me that that industrial animal agricultural operations freely feed medically important antibiotics to animals that don't need them under the guise of a term that they called food production medicine. Not only is this practice irresponsible, this practice is putting all of our health at risk. The reality is that industrial animal agriculture is abusing those antibiotics that we rely on in both human medicine and on the farm. They are feeding our antibiotics to animals that don't need them and that are not sick. Medically important antibiotics should not be a replacement for good animal husbandry, and the practice of feeding subtherapeutic medicines to animals must come to an end. House Bill 2598 makes perfect sense. It prevents the misuse of antibiotics in confinement operations while continuing to allow therapeutic use of medicines where there are no other options on the farm. Further, the reporting requirement of this bill would only apply to federally defined concentrated animal feeding operations, which are a small percentage of the farming operations that we have here in Oregon. I ask for your support of HB 2598 so that we can keep our antibiotics working for your family and mine. Thank you.
Perfect, and right on time, too.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Molesky with Friends of Family Farmers. We represent family farmers and ranchers across Oregon, and we support House Bill 2598 today. This bill is intended, as you've heard, to prevent the indiscriminate use of medically important antibiotics for non-therapeutic purposes in livestock, while also protecting the ability of farmers and veterinarians to use antibiotics appropriately to treat sick animals and prevent the spread of disease outbreaks. As an organization representing family-scale producers that use antibiotics responsibly, we support this bill as a reasonable step to prevent overuse of antibiotics in large-scale animal confinement settings where it is most likely to occur, and to prevent the development and spread of antibiotic-resistant bacteria linked to these types of operations. While human health concerns related to antibiotic-resistant bacteria are substantial, responsible livestock producers also need antibiotics to work properly when they do administer them. Under this bill, producers can continue to use antibiotics to treat sick animals, but would be appropriately prohibited from using medically important antibiotics for non-medical purposes such as growth promotion, weight gain, feed efficiency, and disease prevention in healthy groups of animals. Further, Section 4 of the bill outlines circumstances when farmers or veterinarians may administer antibiotics more broadly when a disease or infection is in fact present within a group of animals and antibiotics are needed to stop the outbreak. We believe this provision to be quite reasonable and addresses many of the concerns that a veterinarian's raised today while allowing responsible antibiotic use where it's appropriate to treat medical issues. Some may argue that this is a federal matter. To our knowledge, there is no federal law in place that actually makes the requirements to stop using medically important antibiotics in these non-medical ways. And furthermore, the Federal Food and Drug Administration has been far too slow to address these issues. Current federal rules are voluntary. I have to remind you that federal governments change. We don't always necessarily know who's going to be in power, and we're not necessarily confident that the solution here is going to come from Washington, D.C. So, and despite these federal rules, you know, there's the issue here is increasing. In fact, in a recent case linked to a company with operations in Oregon, antibiotic-resistant salmonella found on Foster Farms chickens sickened over 500 people in 27 states between May 2013 and July 2014. We've got to show leadership on this issue in Oregon. I'll simply close by saying that Section 5 requires a common sense reporting for the largest confinement operations. We think that's highly appropriate and doable. And lastly, we understand there's concerns around the citizen suit provision. While we're not scared of a provision like this or believe that the sky will fall, we're also open to discussing how that could be more reasonable for the folks who are concerned about it. And we've talked to some of the folks behind the bill to try to address those concerns. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning and welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And thank you for considering this issue today. For the record, my name is Victoria Taylor, and I'm a sophomore economics major at Lewis and Clark. And although I'm not from Oregon, I have come to call it home in the past couple of years, and I'm thrilled to be speaking with you all today. So in my lifetime, I've only taken antibiotics for a couple of minor reasons, though a close friend of mine, Shanley Mitchell, isn't as lucky as I am. When we were 16, Shanley contracted bacterial meningitis that reached her spinal fluid, forcing doctors to place her in a medically induced coma and isolation for 2 weeks. And during those 2 weeks, she was administered dexamethasone through IV to fight the lethal infection. And fortunately, it worked. But now, 4 years later, dexamethasone is one of the many antibiotics that are less effective because of resistant bacteria. So, at the beginning of last semester, I started interning with Augsburg because I think educating the public on issues they may not be aware of is incredibly important. And I also love working for campaigns and talking about politics. I actually first started volunteering for campaigns when I was 11 back in Florida, knocking on doors with a clipboard and making phone calls for Representative Clay Shaw. So I was extremely excited to begin calling Augsburg members a few weeks ago and to talk to them about our Save Antibiotics campaign. The large number of Oregonians who were already aware of this pressing health concern and were excited to change things by calling their representatives surprised me. They were willing to do things. And this issue will not go away. We need to act immediately because if we don't, more people will die every year. If factory farms continue to administer these unnecessary antibiotics daily in their feed, the antibiotics will stop working for people who actually need them, like my friend Shanley. So luckily, I haven't come into contact with any form of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. But that's not to say it's not possible for me or anyone in this room too. I'm standing before you today asking you to value the health and future of your constituents and your children over that of special interests, and to please pass House Bill 2598. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions? Not seeing any. Thank you all very, very much. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Tom Keck, Michael Joubest, and Jerome Rosa, please. We've got three more. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Chairman Witt, members of the committee, my name is Tom Keck. I'm a practicing veterinarian from Dallas, Oregon. Past president of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, served 9 years on the Veterinary Medical Examining Board, and presently on the board of directors of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. I have to address something that was just said. The young lady is misguided. Dexamethasone is not an antibiotic. Dexamethasone is a corticosteroid, completely different class of drugs, has nothing to do with livestock feed, and in fact, yes, her friend was saved by it because of its anti-inflammatory effects. It is not an antibiotic, and I hope that she does some research on that. The problem that is seen with this bill is that it is not addressing the real elephant in the room, and that is antibiotic resistance in the human side. That is a human problem. We've heard about compliance. We've heard about the fact that human antibiotics aren't working as well. Most of the antibiotics, the large percentage you've heard that are used in food animals, are not even used in human medicine. They're completely different. Not only that, we have withdrawal times so that those antibiotics are not found in the products when they go to the market. In addition, most of the diseases that we're dealing with in food animals are not even caused by the same bacteria that are in humans. These things all have to be addressed. Truthfully, if you want to do something that is good in controlling of antibiotics in animals, Osberg would have been better guided to have introduced a bill to completely do away with all over-the-counter sales of antibiotics and put it under direct control of licensed veterinarians. That's the real issue. Let's get this under control of the professionals that know what they're doing with them instead of just random usage. Thank you.
Perfect timing.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Michael Giebert, and I have a small farm in East Multnomah County, and I'm also the board chair of the East Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District, but I'm speaking today on behalf of myself and my farm and not representing the district in any way. On my farm, we raise dairy cows, goats, chickens, pigs, and turkeys, and despite what you heard earlier about pigs not being able to be raised outdoors, we do raise our pigs outside, and they thrive. You know, it's common knowledge that overuse of any medication can lead to resistance. Medications are not 100% effective, and that small remainder that survives can continue to provide resistance in the animal or herd. And you also heard that of the 18 antibiotic-resistant threats identified in the CDC report, only two of them are related to agriculture, and that's true, Salmonella and Campylobacter. And but those two illnesses are responsible for 2.5 million illnesses a year and 570 deaths. And while Salmonella is still 98%, there's still 98% effectiveness with antibiotics with Salmonella, Campylobacter has 25% antibiotic resistance. And if trends continue, those numbers are certainly going to rise. And we want to keep the antibiotics effective for Salmonella. And while the FDA is set to voluntarily regulate growth promotion usage of antibiotics in livestock, they're not restricting disease prevention. And also you heard that the labels are changing. The label is the law, but veterinarians also have the ability to prescribe off-label usage so that the use for growth promotion could continue. So as a small-scale producer, I raise my animals in a way that is promotes animal health and environmental health. And I want to have the confidence that if I do have an animal that gets sick, I want to be able to continue to use antibiotics and have the confidence that they will work. So please, I urge you to pass HB 2598. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Morning, Chairman Rowett. Members of the committee, my name is Jerome Rose. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, representing our roughly 2,000 members in Oregon's largest agricultural commodity, beef it up, over $1 billion of sales this past year. We can all agree that healthy animals are the basis of a healthy, humane, and safe food supply. Farmers and ranchers use a variety of tools, including vaccines, good nutrition programs, and proper housing to keep animals healthy. Antibiotics are only one tool in a plan of good production practices to raise healthy farm animals. Farmers, ranchers, and veterinarians are required by law to follow the FDA approved label and administer the drug appropriately and correctly. There are regulatory safeguards in place to ensure the labels are being followed. FDA approves antibiotics and the specific dosage rates to treat specific diseases or conditions, and producers are legally required to follow these precise label directions. This rigorous approval process was made more stringent in 2003 when FDA finalized an additional safety measure requiring an antibiotic resistant assessment for all new and existing antibiotics. The beef community has invested in quality assurance programs, research, and education designed to maintain high standards of animal care and health to help us continually improve how we use antibiotics. The livestock community, including farmers, ranchers, veterinarians, and the federal government and the animal health companies, have made it to where antibiotics are proactively working together, continuously improve the way we responsibly use antibiotics in livestock. Guidance 209 and 213 will eliminate growth promotion uses of medically important antibiotics and extend veterinary oversight. Within about 3 years, any medically important antibiotics used in animals will only be for therapeutic uses and under the supervision of a veterinarian. On March 26th, the FDA announced that animal health companies took the next step in this process by voluntarily agreeing to phase out the use of antibiotics for growth promotion in animals. The companies will either withdraw these antibiotics from use in animals completely or will only allow them to be used in a veterinarian's prescription.
Mr. Rosa? I'm going to have to cut you off. I apologize.
That's okay. I thought I had 3 minutes, and I had 3 minutes of speech.
You did the best 3 minute job in 2 minutes we've heard today.
I was trying to get my money's worth.
Anything from the committee?
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, very, very much. And our last panel this morning is Chris Eggert, Ian Tolleson, and Mark Silva. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ian Tolleson, Government Affairs Director for Northwest Food Processors Association. We are opposed to this legislation. I think it's been made fairly clear that the science isn't supported, and this has been taken up on the federal level. I think it's important to realize in earlier testimony we heard of an outbreak that unfortunately sickened some people. We in the food industry take food safety of the utmost care. That's our number one business, and when something happens, we try to do everything we can to curtail that. However, if this bill was in place, there was no guarantee that this would have stopped that illness. Many of our food processing plants are located throughout the 50 states. We represent Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, of course, and that plant has facilities throughout those states. So this bill would have done nothing to prevent that. But I would just like to speak on something that has been brought up here, and that is the portion of the bill that talks about civil lawsuits by a private citizen. That is a very dangerous precedent to set here. You know, there has been other states where we've seen a rise of really a cottage industry of plaintiff's attorneys going around fishing for these types of cases. It ties our members up in litigation, which can increase the price of food, and ultimately doesn't get at any of the food safety matters at hand here in this bill. So with that, I will stop my testimony and thank you for your opposition on the bill.
Thank you very much.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Chris Eggert. I'm a dairy farmer in the Northern Willamette Valley, and I'm also the president of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. So I'm representing the over 240 farm families that raise milk in the state of Oregon in everyone's district on the committee, with the exception of Rep. Frederick and I believe Representative Gorsuch, although if we can try to get a dairy farm in there, we will. I wanted to come to you today. The Oregon Dairy Farmers Association opposes this bill. We believe that for the reasons that veterinarians who know a lot more about animal health than I do can tell you is that this is something that needs to be done on a federal level. Oregon does a great product, raises great products, both meat and milk, but we don't produce all the food that we eat. So we're going to put this special set of regulations on only the food that we create in the state of Oregon, not all the food that is consumed in the state of Oregon. I think this is something that needs to be done on a federal level, and it's already being done on a federal level. As well, We'll have concerns with the reporting standpoint because reporting then is a public record, which I don't see the purpose of that. And because of the way that, although they say that's federally recognized confined animal operation, all dairies in the state of Oregon that produce milk are considered a confined animal feeding operation. So this affects all 240 farms in the state of Oregon, from 10 cows to the largest farm in the state, which has significantly more. As well, we have over 50 organic farms in the state of Oregon who, myself included, only use antibiotics to save the life of an animal. We would have to fill out this report that would document that we basically didn't do anything. I think it's another layer of regulation that the state doesn't need to be involved in, and I thank you for your time today.
Thank you both very, very much. Committee members, Representative Whitsitt.
I'd just like to say that dairy and cattle combined are Oregon's largest agricultural commodity, and agriculture, that being the second largest of all the commodities in Oregon. So we're looking at a potential of billions of dollars of gross domestic product change to some effect if we rule on this against large animal herds.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean.
I know we all have to go, and we all tried to keep our questions to the minimum so everybody could speak, but we understand that everybody in here has the same goal, and that is a safe food supply, and also that we're doing the right thing for humans and our livestock and food supply. And so we know you're all good people. There's no bad actors. We're just trying to figure out how to get to the right place. And I appreciate all the energy and all the information and everything else that was brought in here today as far as personal experiences and also studies and science. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair McLean. And before we close this hearing, gentlemen, thank you so much. I want to thank the public for the manner in which you conducted yourselves on a rather controversial subject. You respected the process entirely. You respected the opinions of other people. I did not even hear a groan in the audience. You're all, every one of you, great Oregonians. I am closing the hearing on House Bill 2598. Thank you.
One
There's a certification.
How many constituents do you have out there?
How many constituents do you have out there?